Hey folks, welcome to This Anthro Life. This is Adam Gamwell. Now, depending on how far you've dipped your toes into social science, you might have heard the terms qualitative and quantitative associated with research. Now, generally, we think of cultural anthropology as a qualitative social science. That is, we study the cultural meanings, attitudes, perceptions, and behaviors of people by observing them, talking with them, spending time in, well, their natural habitats. Now, on the other side, you've got quantitative data. This is data collected from surveys of many people, or information collected online from sources like product reviews on websites and commenters on articles. Now, these data sets tend to be larger because it's easier to use the computers to collect them. You may have also heard the term big data to refer to particularly large data sets. Now, the primary difference between these two approaches to research is that quantitative and big data tend to be really good at telling you what is happening at a large scale. They can reveal patterns and changes over time pretty easily. But they can't tell you the nuances or meanings around why something is changing. And that's why qualitative data is useful. It's great for getting into the nuance and context about why people feel a particular way, and allows for attention into things like cultural dynamics, power relations, and even changes in language. Generally, these two methods have worked side by side, but haven't really crossed over. That is, there hasn't really been a lot of work that has successfully crossed big data with ethnography. Now, intrepid listeners may remember that we did an episode with tech ethnographer Tricia Wong a while back about why big data needs thick data. That is, why big data sets need qualitative nuance. Or in other words, why big data and quantitative data need qualitative so that we can understand how the data was created, what tools were used, and for what reasons. But what if there were a way to do ethnography with big data? That is, what if there were a way to be able to understand the nuances of cultural meaning that people assign to things from big data sets? What this entails is, in essence, quantifying ethnography. And it turns out, the key has to do with focusing on meaning. That and some computer science wizardry. Now, I'm excited today to have on the show one of the pioneers in this field. Ujjwal Arkelgud is a CEO, cultural anthropologist, and co-founder of MotiveBase, a global tech research firm that has cracked the cultural code and developed software and research tools that bring together the analytical power of anthropology and the wide reach of big data. In this episode, we're going to dig into the concept of microcultures. These are sets of meanings that make up a market space. We'll look at the need to study meaning and behavior in business and question why companies don't think about meaning as one of the main ways that people act and make, well, meaning out of their lives. We'll look into why traditional market research doesn't effectively get at meaning, and how the internet has changed the way that we make culture and meaning, and that betting on cultural homogenization, that is, that we're all moving to be one culture, is, in the words of Admiral Akbar, a trap. All right, let's get to it. So Ujjwal, thanks for joining me on This Anthro Life today.
Thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm a fan, and I've definitely been listening to you for a while now, so it's cool to be invited to the podcast.
Yeah. I'm really excited about the broader context of bringing cultural anthropology and sociological thinking and theories into the corporate world, into business. And, you know, business anthropology isn't new, but when I started reading about your work and the company that you run, you seems like you're taking a bit of a different and more innovative approach to bringing cultural anthropology, sociology into business and into corporate environments around the concept of meaning, right? In a broad sense of what does it mean to bring meaning into conversations of innovation. So I wonder if you could kick us off by helping us think about what's the deal with meaning? You know, why does it seem to be lacking so often in the corporate world, and how can we, you know, bring it to life?
First and foremost, I think what's interesting for me is just that the focus or the study of meaning, especially in the business context, is generally not talked about that much. And it almost feels like in the world of, you know, applying cultural anthropology to the world of business to solve problems, in particularly in the field of innovation, it feels like the study of behavior is often talked about a lot, especially with various practices that circle around the design thinking process and various versions of those methodologies and so on. There's so much discourse around the study of behavior, but there's very little about the study of meaning. And that is something that always perplexes me, because the thing that got me into anthropology was the study of meaning. What excited me was the realization when I was much younger, living in India, you know, pursuing a engineering degree, like many men in India kind of end up in, and realizing this is not what I'm passionate about. I remember being handed Ludwig Wittgenstein's book, and I remember opening the pages and thinking, what in God's name is this thing? But once you start to get into it and you start to take a step back and think about what he was trying to say, it completely changes your mindset and your approach. And I remember that was a moment in my own sort of personal and professional development that I'm always reminded of, because it helped me realize, you know, how important studying the structure of language is to understanding the structure of the world. And studying the structure of language is really nothing but the study of meaning, and how we inadvertently as human beings give meaning to everything and anything that we surround ourselves in. And of course, I think what's even more fascinating is that, you know, people like Wittgenstein and many others that came after him operated in a world where, I guess I could arguably say that the world was a lot less complex than it is now. And, you know, they didn't have the internet at their disposal. So now we sit in a world where there's more complexity, there's more nuance, but there's also more ways to get at the nuance. And I think that's what excites me every single day, is the ability to study meaning, but to study meaning in ways that can be agile, can be quick, can leverage big data, and so on and so forth. And I remember we had this great moment with one of our first clients where they were doing a sensory test and they were studying the behavior of people eating dark chocolate. And they were doing all these sensory tests, and, you know, they were blind tests, and they had amazing results for some of their formulations. And I remember asking the client, I remember asking him specifically, do you know what would happen if you actually told the person trying it of what those ingredients were that went into it? And I remember his response was, what difference would that make? And I said, well, this is why you hired us, because what you're going to realize is that taste and convenience and all those things that you think make all this logical sense will get thrown out the window. Because the moment you tell this person, depending on who this person is, of course, the moment you tell them what the ingredients are, they will have a set of meanings they hold around some of those ingredients. And either that will help them buy more or buy whatever it is that you're selling, or it'll help them never touch it again. It doesn't matter whether they love the taste or not. I think that's the part that's exciting to me, and the value of the study of meaning that's often ignored.
I think that's a really fascinating point. And so let's break that down a little bit, because the chocolate is a great example, a great way to think of all things. But, you know, if I'm taste testing a new flavor, there's some hazelnut in there, or some pink sea salt or whatever. So a company is then, I guess, working with taste testers, which sounds like a pretty cool thing to do anyway. You probably get paid $40 to try chocolate or something. But then what I hear you saying is that when you actually say, let's pause and contemplate and let the consumer know if it's a certain kind of sugar, or if you have, you know, raw or refined cacao or some kind of nut butter or something, like what are the ingredients that are in it? And that's going to then affect ultimately more than the taste, if a consumer will actually continue to eat that chocolate or not. And that's a really fascinating point that on one level kind of blows my mind that that corporations or companies or organizations don't think about meaning as one of like the primary movers. And so thinking of two questions, one is like, why do you think that has been the case? But then the other question is, so just thinking about what does it look like to infuse meaning into these kinds of questions, right?
Right. Maybe I'll start with your first question. I guess the surprising part is, why isn't it used often? And I think it is used, but it's used in a rather logical sense in in terms of putting a bunch of consumers in a room and then asking them about what they think of, you know, certain types of products and ingredients and so on. And we started this session with Wittgenstein, so I'll go back to that. There was a great quote from him, and I can't remember the exact specifics, so I'm paraphrasing, but it basically points to this notion that it's very hard for us as human beings to not deceive ourselves. It's harder than we think it is. And we see in the corporate world, it's often ignored, primarily because it's easy. It's easy to say, person ABC thinks high fructose corn syrup is very unhealthy, and therefore we must avoid high fructose corn syrup. And by the way, we have some taste tests where we prove that high fructose corn syrup product tasted just as well in the blind test as the cane sugar product. So great, let's go with the cane sugar product. That narrative is an easy one for researchers to manage up with. And I think, you know, oftentimes it comes back down to, can I manage up with the outcomes? Can I make decisions fast enough? But of course, the challenge is that oftentimes the wrong decision gets made because the underlying meanings aren't entirely understood. At best, you know, the product just goes nowhere. At worst, it and blows up in people's faces, right? And becomes a PR issue, a PR nightmare, and that, you know, there's so many stories of that as well. But I think for us, the exciting part is to go into these environments and say, okay, I'm not saying don't do all those blind tests and sensory tests, and I'm not saying don't observe people in their kitchens and watch them interact with their families, do all of that good stuff. But before you do that, understand what kinds of meanings you are walking into when you talk about certain things, because your words have implications. So let's understand both the implicit and explicit implications there. Because if you can understand the implicit meanings, then you know not only how to ask certain questions, but how to ask the right questions. And you also understand the innate relationships that certain things will hold when you bring them to market. You know, exactly like the example you used, we may learn through the study of meaning that fair trade must go hand in hand with cane sugar. I mean, kind of sounds obvious now, but there is a relationship between the two of them. And that relationship comes because people who hold certain values and certain beliefs dear to their heart, and the two link together. And in that case, it might be a link between healthfulness and a link between ethics. There might be other such links that exist for us to understand the broader sort of frame of that linkage, but also the specific components, you know, what the ingredients or what the specific type of packaging or what a particular type of product design shape says about the world and about the world that your consumer lives in. That's really, really important to understand.
Yeah. And so it's interesting too, because then it's not just about getting someone to say, I like this or dislike that, or even that I want fair trade or don't want fair trade, but it's really hard for us not to deceive ourselves, which suggests that as much as we may think we know ourselves, there's a lot of things that we don't, that kind of happen under the surface. This is not to say that humans are dumb, but right, we have a lot of implicit associations with all kinds of, with everything, right? I mean, it's almost like the other Clifford Geertz quote that culture is just this web of meanings that we spin for ourselves that we live in, right? Everything is part of this web. And it's interesting to then think we're taking that and on one level, just helping bring it more explicitly into the business context. And you raise an interesting point too, that there is kind of a challenge of managing up in this case, because unless you have perhaps a chief research officer or something in the C-suite or the executive leadership, oftentimes it's a research team that is working below that, right? And then they have to sort of go upwards saying, hey, we're trying to look at this, the sense of the meanings. One thing that's interesting too, that you've got a really great book called Microcultures that talks a lot about this process, because I want to talk a bit about that, helps break down some of these processes. And one of the chapters in the book that feels pertinent to this is this idea that traditional market research, segmentation, and demographics don't actually get at the kinds of meanings that we're talking about here, right? And that they ultimately fall short because they're either putting people in boxes or kind of missing some of the points, I suppose.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit about why traditional market research doesn't do well at getting at meaning?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first part of the narrative we've sort of touched upon already, and I love that quote you mentioned as well. You know, traditional market research relies on asking consumers, and that's pretty common practice. And there are things you can ask and there are things you can't ask. I mean, you can give people two slices of bread and ask them which one they prefer. That's an easy question to answer. But you can't ask them a complex question of how they choose or how they decide what type of bread to buy. Don't ask that question. You're never going to get a real answer. And again, to your point, it's not because consumers are actively trying to deceive us. It's because as human beings, it's just difficult. Our brains don't, I mean, it's biology. Our brains just don't work that way. Most of the time, the decision is already made by our so-called reptilian brain. And by the time we actually figure out how to articulate that with our modern brain, it's, you know, already a diluted, somehow turned into logic argument that we make, right? And I think it's hard to argue against that. But let's leave that aside for a second. Here's the part that, and we wrote a couple of chapters on this. Here's the part that gets me both riled up and very, very passionate about why cultural anthropology and the study of meaning is so important to the world of business. And I'll give you a classic example, the study of millennials. My God, every time I hear that M word, I just, you know, there's something that happens in my brain every time I hear that M word. And by the way, a lot of anthropologists, a lot of social scientists, sociologists are also guilty of following this bandwagon. And, you know, I'm not calling them out. I'm just reminding them that it's our job, our collective responsibility to push people who don't have the knowledge that we get to accumulate, to push them out of their comfort zone. And it takes time, it takes energy and effort, and it's not easy. But let me talk about a couple of the reasons why I think it's so important. There's a history of betting on this notion of cultural homogenization. And this history isn't modern. I'm referring to 100 years back. And obviously, we're talking about cultural anthropology. You look at the work of people like Boas and Mead and Sapir and others. It's all follows in this pathway. The type of homogenization that back in the day that the powers that be wanted and desired was not humanly possible. But, you know, we can't assume that, you know, I was born in India, so I'll use that as an easy example. We can't assume that everybody who's of Indian descent who comes into the United States is somehow, quote unquote, barbaric in their practices because they eat with their hands. And that's not that's not sophisticated. That's not the right set of meanings. Those kinds of assumptions are what I mean by this bet on cultural homogenization. We want people to come to, for example, North America, to Canada, to the United States. We want them to come and we want them to become like the so-called European elite, right? And we want them to become like that because that's supposed to be the right way to live, whereas all the other cultures are supposed to be the wrong way to live. We don't even realize it, but we are doing the same thing. By saying all millennials behave the same way, we're doing exactly the same thing. We're saying, oh, everybody between this age and some arbitrarily defined age, by the way, everybody between this age and this age must all behave the same way. All millennials are lazy, right? This is a classic narrative. It's the same thing. And the same thing also applies to, you know, oh, I'm studying African Americans. I'm studying Hispanics. Our job as anthropologists becomes to work with our clients to help them move away from those models, to teach them that you want to study the African-American community, great, let's do that. But please do not assume that all African-Americans hold the same belief systems, same value systems, behave the same way, and therefore are different from the rest of the population. And I think even though these things are not said out loud, they're assumed and they're baked into the assumptions. And those assumptions make their way into research practices like, let's study millennials, let's study African Americans, let's study Asian Americans, and so on. As an organization, at least for my organization, we're really trying to fight that narrative because the proof is out there, right? Every time we do a genuine anthropological study of people, we see the meanings and we see how those meanings are held by all sorts of people. Yes, certain meanings may have skews, but it's never truly just about one group of people. And so that's really what we've been talking about applying the lens of anthropology. In the book, we talk about helping organizations think like anthropologists. Because when you start to think like anthropologists, you realize there's meaning underlying everything. And when you think through the lens of meanings, that's in essence what we mean by microcultures. Microcultures to us are nothing but sets of meanings that make up a marketplace. And when you think through the lens of meanings, you start to realize, oh, interesting. It's actually not age cohorts or, you know, generational cohorts or racial cohorts that compete with one another for power, prestige, authority in a given space. It's actually these meaning-based cohorts, and that's what we call microcultures. Going back to the chocolate example, there might be a microculture that really believes in ethics that sits in, you know, kind of tension with a microculture that just cares about the sweetest tasting, cheapest chocolate. And so then when you look at the macroculture of chocolate and you explore all these microcultures, the question becomes, which microcultures can we tackle as an organization that we are best positioned to handle? And then when we can make that decision, then we understand who the audience really truly is going to be or who they are. And I think that's what we're trying to get to. And that's the part that excites us.
That's really interesting too, because it's almost like pulling away from some of the exact characteristics that you tend to see in traditional research, right? Like demographics or generations it's funny, it makes your blood boil. I kind of agree with you too. Whenever I read market studies, it's like Gen Z does this. It's like, that's a large swath of people, you know, and they have the same age, but they happen to be across the globe. So it's assuming they would be the same is almost a form of insanity, it feels like, right? But the idea is, if this idea of microcultures, if I'm understanding right, is about getting around meaning. And that's a really fascinating way of basically seeing how people's actions and what they say, what they may not say, or what their actions say about themselves is kind of a way of identifying them. And so it's cool because it actually seems like it's the opposite of what you hear in most common market research, right? Or how businesses try to identify who their consumers are, right? They try to ID, like, we're trying to get this hipster market, you know, and it's like, well, okay, right. But not all hipsters are the same, right? We have our what, from metrosexuals into lumbersexuals into
exactly
tattoos.
Right. You know. I just thought I'd build on one point you made, which is, you know, imagine a world where all we care about are these sets of meanings, and meanings are different in different contexts. And the reason why I say imagine a world is that now I'm going to say we actually exist in that world. We just don't realize it, because the same person who swears by buying ethical chocolate will turn around and buy skincare products that are tested on animals and not think twice, right? Why is that the case? Are they being untruthful? Are they being inauthentic? No. Nobody is actively going, oh yeah, I'm going to cheat myself today. That's not how human beings work, right? It's just that there are different meanings that hold more value in a given context than other meanings. And I use this example, like, maybe it's more important to me as a human being to sit around a dinner table and boast about how all the food I buy are from local, you know, butchers and local farms rather than grocery stores. And, you know, the chocolate I buy is fair trade and the coffee beans I buy is fair trade and single origin and blah, blah, blah. Maybe that's more important to me than it is to say, hey, by the way, I don't buy XYZ skincare products because they're all tested on animals and, you know, they use certain types of ingredients that are horrible. I think what's interesting is understanding how those meanings change from one context to the next. And instead of worrying about the one person, we worry about the meanings in a context, because that's the context within which a product is placed or a brand is placed, you know, or a company is placed. And I think that's what we're trying to get at through the methodology and the process.
That's super edifying to think with. And it helps yeah, very clearly see this is why it's not so much about the people themselves, because as you clearly point with chocolate or something like, you know, vegan leather is another example that comes to mind, right? That you may have a belt you bought on Amazon that's leather, but then you then want to go out and purchase a vegan leather satchel.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious also to think about, as you develop this as a business practice and as a way of helping clients and businesses understand how to think more with meaning, some of the pieces that come into play here, it seems, and I know you mentioned some of these in microcultures too, is we've mentioned Boaz and Mead here, but then also there's folks like Pierre Bourdieu in his notion of taste, right? Or the idea of how do we come to like or kind of form the meanings that make differences to us. And so the idea of focusing on meanings, again, not as a generational thing or as a demographic thing, but since these meanings will change based on context, that has to do a lot with this concept of social capital, right? So I'd love to kind of break down a little bit and get your perspective on the idea of social capital, right? Or how we compete with that around meanings as one of the theoretical frameworks, right? And I don't mean to get into a theory debate, but partially the point of my question here is to show folks that theory actually does have an important implication for how we can understand and work in the real world, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. People are often surprised by how much the work of academics and, so broadly speaking, social sciences theory has played a role in the development of our technology. What Bourdieu did really, really well was take the notion of meaning and translate it into the notion of capital. And I think he realized that certain meanings give you this intangible currency. And this intangible currency you trade. And, you know, obviously the most common example, especially in the American circumstance, would be, you know, an Ivy League education, right? Classic example. Yeah. Or, you know, to use a more, I guess, a more blatant example, it would be the type of car or the brand of car you drive, how big your home is, which neighborhood you live in, and, you know, combination of those things. And, you know, Bourdieu talks a lot about that in his book Distinction, and also talks about that in a couple of other pieces of his work. And that really inspired us because it helped us realize that, yes, we're studying meaning, but the study of meaning is almost meaningless without realizing why we're doing it. And the reason we're doing it is we have to teach our clients about the forms of symbolic capital that are developing within their cultural markets. And I say cultural markets because, you know, a marketplace is as a consumer thinks of it as, not as, you know, an industry defines it as. And so within that cultural marketplace, we have to figure out what are the forms of symbolic capital developing and which forms of symbolic capital are somehow more prominent than others, which forms of symbolic capital are maybe growing faster than others. In our book, we use the example of, you know, that video that exposed the treatment of cows and baby calves in a farm that was owned by Fairlife. And I remember seeing that news story and doing a series of projects in relation to that, because we do work with a lot of companies that operate in the dairy space. And I remember watching a few months after that video came out. You know, until that video came out, the microculture of animal welfare was there, but there was no significant growth in it. It was kind of as if the meanings around that were important to a small niche group of consumers. It wasn't really growing. And then that thing came about and it gained steam, you know, it got energized. And that form of symbolic capital became stronger than some other forms of symbolic capital that were owning the dairy and milk landscape until then. And now that is slowly transforming what dairy is and will mean to American consumers in the next little while. But those kinds of cultural moments, we can look back on in history and say those are seminal moments because they, you know, they add fuel to whatever form of symbolic capital that was dormant. They add fuel to the fire and they give strength. And that's what's interesting to us. And what we have done with our technology is actually model this kind of thinking so that we can actually build, track a model with which we can understand meanings, the forms of symbolic capital, how many people these meanings are relevant to and how that's changing over time. So that's in essence what we do as a company, but it's all born out of the work of all these incredible academics. So, you know, if there's ever a PhD out there that's thinking, oh, you know, I'm publishing another journal article, what impact will this have? Well, it has massive impacts, right? It just depends, I guess, on who reads it and when. Sometimes the impact may occur 100 years later, but it's impactful nonetheless.
So the message, the moral of the story is that there is hope for anthropologists that are trying to have an impact out there. And I appreciate that kind of rendition, right? And the Fairlife dairy example is really poignant because it was this dairy company that was really up and coming and had begun to corner the market by having milk that had less sugar. So it's interesting. There's already some association that milk was too sugary, right? Or a little bit less fat or something, right? So they're making quote unquote healthier milk. But then this video went viral on online, YouTube, and overnight their symbolic capital plummeted, but then also there was the economic implications of that too, definitely, right? And so it's interesting to realize like there is this deep connection that meaning is intimately also tied to economics, right? And that people's purchasing choices and what they'll choose to support or boycott in this case are ultimately tied up with this. So the idea that like employees being bad to animals then cost the company millions of dollars. And that's a really fascinating an important point for businesses if they don't know this already, like to pay attention to, right? That symbolic capital may not a term that they may not use often, but they should. And it's a way to contemplate how might economic decisions get made by consumers. And so sure, it's bad PR to have this video out there, but really on top of losing a lot of money, then people don't trust your brand anymore, right? And recovering that trust is, you know, a PR fire is way harder to put out than kind of build a new idea, right?
And if I can just build on that, you know, what's interesting for us is that these kinds of incidents happen often in different industries, right? For various reasons. Pharmaceuticals, a great example, right? Of stuff that happens in the industry. Yeah. But I think what's interesting is when you look at an issue like this through the lens of symbolic capital, you might actually realize that certain issues are, you know, there's a big deal made in the media about the issue, but to the consumer, it's not that important. Or when the consumer translates that into currency, it doesn't give them that much money, right?
Yeah.
Whereas there are other issues that sometimes the media doesn't make a big enough deal of, but it actually makes a big difference in the capital and in what kind of status, power, prestige that will diminish for the consumer who is now seen as using that product or using or advocating for that brand. So that's what's interesting to us is to add that perspective. And that analysis we can do very quickly with agility, but being able to do that gives people a perspective that they otherwise wouldn't have. And you know, this goes back to the let's teach you to think like an anthropologist. This is a classic example of that, right? Where let's understand what the underlying meanings are before we decide what we're going to do with it.
Interesting. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. But teaching a business to think like an anthropologist is just having this understanding that what are the meanings that a consumer or a group of people will have around a product or an idea. It's a great point too, that a viral video won't necessarily affect the economics if consumers don't care about it, right? You know, there's a mechanism in here that I think is super important to talk about, and that is this little thing called the internet that has really change the way that people can communicate, like both the speed at which information can travel, but also kind of to speak to one of your points you made earlier, that part of the business model that you guys are working towards is to get people away from the idea that we're moving towards some kind of cultural homogenization, right? And so it's interesting because just because we have more global communication does not mean that we're becoming the same culture. And then on top of that, and one of the arguments that you guys put out that I think is really important with this too, is that we are entering this interesting era of much more market fragmentation, right? And so because of that, there's more kinds of products and services on offer. You can bring ideas. I mean, one of the examples I'm thinking of too is the idea of the razor, right? The shaving club and the idea of men's grooming in general, right? But a razor in this simple case of, you know, I think it was Gillette for over a century was like the dominant company that was, you know, producing shaving goods. And then we have, you know, Dollar Shave Club or Harry's, these kind of subscription-based razor companies that do the same thing. They sell a razor, you know, but they have built different meanings around it in terms of why it is good to, you know, save money and to groom. But they were able to put these companies together with much less capital because they were able to either get manufacturing deals or something from across the globe. And that totally, quote unquote, disrupted the shaving industry. But at the same time, it goes to show that, like, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath, right? This is no longer about having just these mega corporations, but that so many other kinds of businesses, small groups, organizations, startups can enter into the space and totally disrupt something if they get the right meaning. And so, you know, the internet did not become this machine that we're all swirling and becoming the same culture, but it became on one level like this leveler of how people could enter the market and to make products and services. Yeah. And also the information flow, right? And that's, I think, partially to, you know, a lot of the models that you guys build and work on is based on this too. We have this access to so much information, right? And that's kind of where this big data piece, I think, is super important too.
Yeah, no, it's a really important point. And, you know, what we are finding is that, let's take Reddit as an example. You can pretty much find a subreddit, for those of you who are not familiar, a subcommunity within reddit.com. You can pretty much find a subreddit on anything you can think of. And that subreddit will have people from all over the world. There'll be somebody from France, somebody from China, somebody from India, from the United States, so on and so forth. And all of these people are there not because they share a similar passion. They're there because they also share a similar set of values, belief systems, and they're also trading and engaging with a similar set of meanings. And that's what plops them into a small subreddit, subcommunity. And there are hundreds of thousands of them. So what the internet has enabled is it's allowed us to be our type of weird, right? And find other people who are my type of weird, I guess, from around the globe. But because of that, it's actually, you know, created and enabled more fragmentation in culture than it has homogenization. So in essence, culture is actually fragmenting more. And I don't say this in a bad way. It's actually a really good thing. Mm. Culture is becoming more complex. There are more meanings that exist in culture than they ever existed before. And so I think that's the interesting part here that I think a lot of organizations and leaders need to understand, that the internet has actually enabled fragmentation. And I always correct people when they say markets are fragmenting. I remind them, no, no, no. Mm. Culture is fragmenting. Markets are a result of fragmenting culture. Markets are born because culture fragments and people go, I want something different. And somebody creates it. Markets don't create culture. Culture creates market. And I think that's something that people often have to be reminded of. And yeah. I think that's really the interesting thing. That, so you're right. It's a really important point to talk about, because the internet is not enabling homogenization, which means, you know, coming to your second point, modern tools and techniques. So I'm not saying, you know, ours is some sort of holy grail, but this is how we choose to do it. We use artificial intelligence and big data and natural language processing and all the modern tools available to us in order to study the meanings behind what people talk about in any given context. So we use all these tools to study meaning, to study the structure of language and get to meanings and then quantify those meanings. I'm sure there are many other ways that the same thing can be achieved. But the point I'm getting to is that I think what's powerful now is that even though culture is fragmenting, we have more powerful tools and techniques that can help us understand these fragmentations and these sets of meanings in an extremely agile and quick manner. So for example, we do studies, you know, our technology can decode meaning around a topic in 7 seconds. One of our anthropologists, if they're doing an ethnographic analysis for a client, they might use the tool and do a more in-depth analysis over 3 or 5 days and get to the kind of detail that we would get in months and months of research. But just that is progress to us. And it's progress in the modern context because it helps us use modern tools in the context that is appropriate. As in, you know, to understand the modern fragmented context, we have to use modern tools to do that. And I think that's the point I'm trying to get at, is that that's the benefit of the internet. And you know, for me, the biggest joy is when we talk to a new company, they're interested in working with us. When they don't ask this question, I'm the happiest person on planet Earth. And the question is the following. You're studying people on the internet. How do I know about real people?
Right? Yeah.
And that question is now a sort of less and less common, which is, I'm so thankful for that.
That's great, yeah.
Right? And but that's, you know, the reason why less and less people are asking this question is because we are all increasingly realizing that culture is culture. It doesn't matter how you get at it. But the point is, in the modern context, there are certain ways to get at it in a faster and more efficient manner. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I really appreciate that idea of thinking about, that the study of meaning is the study of meaning, right? It's kind of like love is love, people. You know, there's not a fake version of it. But the other idea that it's about using the tools at hand. I think that it's a really neat way to contemplate using, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning and big data as the tools of the trade, right? As that we have access to these collections of information of things like reviews on websites that people that voluntarily leave, or customer reviews for a product, or if you share an article on a news website. So it's interesting that we online have this collection of data that's out there that's freely available. And then we have like a nice calculator, a really nice calculator, right? That can then do these big crunches and pattern recognition of that in a way that just helps us understand meaning in a bigger scale. And so I think that's really interesting too, because what your work does is it mixes together the quantitative trust that we have in numbers, for better or for worse, and in big data, and then the qualitative richness of ethnography, right? That we can still understand the contextual meaning behind things. It isn't simply that 35 people said they like chocolate and 37 said they like vanilla, but it's what are people talking about around these flavors, right?
Yeah, I often tell clients that just because we desire thick data, it doesn't mean the thick data can't also be big. And so we use the term big, thick data to describe our focus because they're not mutually exclusive. And yeah, you can very much get at the richness without giving up the scale. And that's exciting. The other part, since I'm on your podcast, I did want to mention is that we are actively hiring. We're looking for PhDs that are interested in doing this kind of work. You know, I think you captured the essence of it beautifully there a minute ago. For us, the exciting part is we get to do almost what is deeply academic work, but we get to do it in a modern corporate context, and the impact is palpable. You know, as a mantra for us as an organization, we don't wake up in the morning to drive social change, but we end up driving social change because our job as cultural anthropologists is to use the technology to study meanings and to report on the evolution of those meanings. And thankfully, culture, even though I know daily, on a day-to-day basis, it may not seem that way, culture is actually progressing in a positive direction. Humanity is progressing in a positive direction. We can see that. And our job then becomes to quantify that change so that organizations can feel more confident making social impact. Because oftentimes organizations don't make social change because they don't know if the positive impact of it will outweigh the negative impact. And when we see that, we can report on it, and it pushes people to do more with their dollars and with their privilege, right? With that these big corporations have. So even though we don't wake up to do that, we inadvertently drive social change, whether it's, you know, the creation of a brand that cares about size inclusivity and body positivity, or it's, you know, certain policies in terms of how they think about gender and sexuality. There's so many things that have an impact on employees, on customers, on, you know, culture at large. And then in the context of the current pandemic, as well as the ongoing fight for civil rights in the United States, there's so many things that we get to learn and teach our clients about that impacts not just where the money goes, but also where the energy goes within the organization. You know, I kind of jokingly say, if you can show companies where there's money and social impact, they will do it, because ultimately everybody has to make money. And so in many ways, we're able to do that through the work we do. And that excites me because, you know, we get to do that at a scale that we only dreamed of 5 years ago when we started this company.
Yeah, that's incredible too. And I think that what you just said will be very inspiring to many of our listeners too. And that's just understanding that it's possible, probable, and highly likely that you will drive social change doing anthropological work at scale, you know? And so certainly at Motivebase and your company, that's the place to do that. And so as a reminder, to say this again, you guys are actively hiring. So if you're an anthropologist or a social scientist trained person, PhD, even a master's with some training, reach out. I think this is super exciting. And also to me, just a very positive note that things are looking up for anthropology too, as a discipline, as a way of seeing the world, that it's, you know, increasingly, we've seen it kind of enter industry, quote unquote, through user experience. And like that's fine. And that's interesting to see it go there. But talking with you and learning more about Motivebase, this is a company that to me is uniquely positioned on anthropology that it's, I've never seen before. I think that's incredibly powerful and exciting as a indication that anthro is on the up and up, and that there's good folks like yourself that is making it possible. So thank you for putting this together. This is exciting. And this has been a great conversation with you. Is there any places that people want to get in contact with you? Is there any best ways to do that?
First of all, I just wanted to thank you for having me on and for your kind words. Obviously, you know, we sometimes do feel alone in the fight because a lot of our competitors are typical analytics companies. Nothing wrong with that again, but I'm just thinking about it through the lens of being an anthropologist, having all this passion for this field, wanting organizations to think this way. So sometimes we do feel isolated and alone. And when we make progress with bringing on incredible clientele, that's when we see the power of this, and it energizes us every day. And of course, conversations like these energize us as well. So thank you for that. In terms of parting words, if people are interested in learning more about us, they can visit our website, motivebase.com, but it's motive without an E. So motivebase.com. They can also check out our book, Microcultures. It's available on Barnes and Amazon and all the usual places. And otherwise, keep listening to Adam and this AnthroLife.
What a good advertisement. Thanks. Yeah, cheers.
Thank you.
And so, just like Ujjwal said, keep listening to this AnthroLife. And check out their book, Microcultures, if you want to learn more about Ujjwal and Motivebase's approach. I just want to say thanks again to everyone. This AnthroLife has been getting a lot more downloads this past few months, and it's really heartening to see folks get something out of this work. I've had more of you reach out to me to say hi and share your work, and so far I think the furthest away person I've heard from is in China. So thanks for reaching out. It's really humbling and incredible to hear from you, and so please drop me a line. Let me know what you like about the show, what do you want to hear more of, and what you're working on. And if you're a fan of the show, please consider donating to our Patreon. The show is and has been largely self-funded for 7 years now. So if you can spare $5 or $20 a month, you can really help make this possible. A link to Patreon is in our show notes. And as you might have figured out, I'm not super great at marketing the show. So if you happen to be a marketing guru or just know a thing or two and want to help grow this AnthroLife, I'd love to hear from you. So please reach out to me at thisanthrolife@gmail.com. Many thanks to Luciani Shons da Fonseca for editing this episode, and music is provided by Epidemic Sounds. I'm Adam Gamwell. This is This AnthroLife, and we'll see you next time.